Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
Hi, everybody. To those of you who asked me if I were going to be on this panel, and I said no, I wasn't lying. I didn't know it. But like everything else, I never said no. Like Donald just said, I never said no to a drink, so I better never say no to AA. You know, I've always insisted on wanting somebody sober longer than I at the meetings I attend, but this is ridiculous. Gee. I'm the newest kid on the block here. That's pretty neat. I am an alcoholic, though. That's why I'm here, through God's grace. Member of Alcoholics Anonymous, my home group is the Mountain Group that meets at Holy Cross Hospital in Fort Lauderdale on Sundays at 10. And my name is Tommy. Hi. I do have to give Cheshire, Connecticut credit for my first 13 years of the fellowship, though, because I didn't move here to Florida until 1974. How do you express all of your gratitude within a 10-minute period? I think it's important that the only way I can do it is to thank you who are here, because it is through people that the vehicle of the grace of God comes. I always say that I am here through God's grace and cookie sheets, because that last day that I had my drink on Valentine's Day, I took that drink because my husband didn't send me Valentine's. Well, I was 5 days off my last drink, so you'd have thought, you know, I took off my watch and I never even looked at the time. I've got 10 minutes. Okay. So I was 5 days off my last drunk, and that was a long time to have not had a drink. So I drank at him because he gave me cookie sheets, and I didn't think that was very romantic. The only other deliberate drunk I ever had was just at the end of my drinking, in that paranoia-like stage of drinking, you know, where you're so afraid of everything. And my then-husband bought a hearse. And you know what I thought he was going to do with it. He gave me this story. He said, we had 5 children at the time, and we had a station wagon. And he said a hearse is 2 feet longer than a station wagon, so they'd give the children room to grow. And he said, besides, if we're out camping some night and we can't find a place to park in a campground, we'll park along the side of the road. He said, in a hearse, nobody's going to bother us, you know. Well, I was sharing this story one night, and it occurred to me, what if somebody looked in the hearse's window, we all started moving? Well, the next day, he drove the hearse to work. And this was our only car, a family car, I want you to know. And his uncle, with whom he was in business, thought it was a little inappropriate for a doctor to be making house calls in a hearse. Obviously, that hearse left soon, and I came to you very soon after that. And I am so deeply, deeply grateful to have had so many privileges in this fellowship, one of which was participating in the 1965 International in Toronto when we dedicated the I Am Responsible Declaration. And we had the privilege of being part of that ceremony on stage in Toronto. And that became a motto for me. That was written by Al Steckman, who was the third... Oh, I thought he was waving at me. Talk about self-centeredness. Was written by Al Steckman, who was the third editor of the Grapevine and one of the first 100 members in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it states, I am responsible when anyone anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA to always be there, and for that I am responsible. And that's really why I said yes today, when just a few minutes ago when Gwen asked me if I would come up. I am trying to be responsible. You were there when I needed you, and I want to be there when someone else needs us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome. Whee!
Our next speaker is I have the pleasure of sharing my home group with. And when I heard that she was on the panel today, it just put my whole life at ease. I'd like you to welcome Lois. Her sobriety date is March 8th, 1960.
My name is Lois. I'm an alcoholic. They ask us if we could say a few words about how we stay sober today. I don't know how I stay sober today. However, it's been one of those days, you see. I think that, yes, I do know. Because whenever I feel this fluttery, sort of going out of control feeling, I say, please, you take it, I can't handle this. And I get relaxed. Yes, I'm a member of the Happy Hour group. I'm also a member of the Women in Recovery in Boca Raton.
Yes, indeed.
Both meetings are very important to me at this time. I think since I retired, which is approximately 15 years ago, I thought, well, maybe I'll travel a lot. Maybe I'll do this or maybe I'll do that. However, my urge to travel has left since the airlines have all crapped out. And I don't enjoy driving in Florida. I don't know why. I've got a nice, comfortable place in Boca, and I feel very at home there. And within this 15 years, there started some problems, physical problems, that have enabled me not to have the freedom I thought I would have in retirement. Neuropathy, things like osteoporosis, and things like this, which I have a multitude of doctors that I go to, you know, one for each part. And a lot of them never seem to do anything. They ask a lot of questions. They take a lot of notes. They prescribe whatever. And that's it. So that it becomes a bit boring for me, having gone through alcoholism in the 50s, where somewhat the same thing was going on. It's an old story to me that they don't really care too much about patients. And that's how they treated us in the 60s if we showed up at an emergency room. You're an alcoholic? Go someplace else. We don't have beds for you. We only have beds for sick people. So that today is not a new story for me in my life. So I have to take care of it myself. And with God's blessing, I have Alcoholics Anonymous. And I bought myself a little beetle. And I just chug my way back and forth to these meetings, and I have a good time. And the amazing thing to me is the respect that I get for the long-term sobriety I have. And I am delighted to sit here and not be, you know, they said to me I was the youngest. You see, we've done a little shuffling here. And I thought, well, I haven't had that since I was 25 years sober. And I was shocked then. So I go to meetings, and I meet some interesting people. And we have parties in our house. I had a 40-year anniversary, and it had just been here a few years, and the house was full of people laughing and having a good time. And where else would you make that kind of friendship but in Alcoholics Anonymous? I do not feel alone. I am alone many times, but I do not feel alone ever. And that's the blessing of it all. And I thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lois. Next on our panel is Diana. Diana's date is October 31st, 1958.
Good afternoon. My name is Diana, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Diana.
And my home group is the Riverside Group in Tampa, Florida. You know, this is good for me because I reflect back to how I felt when I first came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That horrible, down, defeated thing that I had going on inside of me, not worth much of anything, and being one that attempted suicide several times, I didn't have much self-worth left. And so I reflect back on that because I'm always remembering that, and I think it's important in my sobriety. I have also been very active. As soon as they allowed me to, I started washing cups. And I feel real bad for you people that don't have that chore to start with. We didn't have Stereofoam cups at the time I came into the fellowship. And also, you might find this very hard to believe, but I was one of the youngest. And as one of our previous speakers talked about how they were young when they came in, well, at least he was a man. I was a woman. The only woman that usually was around. I think there were about six other women in Anchorage. I came into Alaska in Anchorage, Alaska. I came into the fellowship in Anchorage, Alaska. And I just seemed to migrate up there. I have traveled all my life, and somehow or other I ended up in Alaska, and you know what they did there? They drank. I fitted. But anyway, I have had some sort of service job ever since I've been in the fellowship. And I believe that that has helped me no end. I know with myself, I have one right now. I'm now chairing this October quarterly that's coming up for South Florida. Now, that's a dandy job. I got a chance to pull a committee together, and then I sit and hold meetings, and they do all the work. I just get to worry. Anyway, I go to at least 3 to 4 meetings a week. I go to my home group, and then I usually go to some other groups. And I love to sit in meetings. And it's been recently when I've been sitting in discussion-type meetings, and I hear some of the younger people talk and tell their history. I said, oh, my God, I did that in school, too. You know, and it's just bringing so many, it brings things back. And I love to hear the sharing, and that helps me in my sobriety. And I never say no, like Tommy said. I never say no when asked to do anything. I was asked a little further back, I think about 3 or 4 hours ago. So so I had it on you, dear. Anyway, How do I tell in 10 minutes what helps keep me sober today? Seeing my friends? Stopping a little bit and saying hello to them? Aren't we blessed? Aren't we blessed that we have this fellowship? I certainly feel that I am. And I seem to feel I have given so little and have received so much. How could I ever say no to anything? And I'm always in there. I like to do things. I'm surprised I didn't sign up to volunteer downstairs because I like to do things in AA. It's fun. And besides, if I'm busy and doing something, I get a chance to talk and meet new people and establish new friends. And that's kind of how I have been staying sober. Am I in 10 minutes? I didn't count. I'm good for now. I'm finished for now. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the 52nd Florida State Convention. All right. My name is Jim Reed, an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February the 5th, 1957. Yeah, I found out I'm an old-timer now. You know, it's such an honor and a pleasure to be able to sit up here, you know, and I'm having such a great time at this convention. I'm being the voice of the convention, and I'm having meeting so many new people, and I'm enjoying myself like I always do. I'm going to talk a little bit more about how I got sober and stayed sober. When I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I come into the Forest Hills Group in Long Island. Yeah. There's a lot of old-timers in that group. That was the oldest group in Long Island, too. And what happened is, when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, a little old gentleman came up to me and put his hand out to me, threw his arms around me, and he says, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Nice to see a young fellow come inside the doors of AA." Today I do the same thing. I greet people at the door when they walk in because I always want to remember when I walked in that door and that man made me feel comfortable. And I was never comfortable before in my life. And that made a difference in my life. And we sat down and he says to me, "Would you like a cup of coffee?" And I was sitting there and I'm shaking and I'm shivering. And I said, "If I can hold it down." And he came back with a cup of coffee. Them days we had cups and saucers. Yeah, I was the only night I got away without washing my own cup and saucer. And when he put that down, I went to pick up that cup, and I want to remember how I felt that night, and I still remember it so clear. And I went to pick up that cup, and I'm shaking like this, and the coffee's going up and down and into the saucer. He said, put it on. "I'll be right back," he says. I said, "Okay." He came back, he broke a straw in half. I had my first cup of coffee out of a straw. Don't you think I want to remember that? You're darn right I do. I want to remember the condition I was when I came in and how I felt inside. And I was shameful. But you know what? I listened. And that old timer told me that day after the meeting was over, he says to me, "I want you to look up at that wall and there's 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all I want you to do is focus on that first step. That's going to be the most important step that you're going to take in your life. But when you take it, you better be honest. Because if you don't, you're not going to make it here." And I did. And he made me repeat that step that night. As sick as I was, I went over. And he says, "I want you to take that step off the wall. I want you to take it home to you. I want to take it to your job or wherever you're going to go. And I want you to keep remembering it and say it over and over." I did it. Because I was scared, and I was feeling, you know, and I was really, really scared. The next week I came back, and everybody greeted me again, and he got a hold of me, and he says to me, "I got another thing for you tonight, and I'm going to give you. And give me the serenity prayer." And he says, "I want you to continue saying that serenity prayer to the rest of your days in AA." And I've said that serenity prayer many, many days, and I needed that prayer to help me with my sobriety. The third week, when I come into the meeting, they had a business meeting. And at that business meeting, everybody sat around and listened, and there was a big group and a lot of members in there. And he said, I need somebody to set up the tables, put the ashtrays out, and get all that set up. Everybody looked in my direction. So I put my hand up, I volunteered. So the man who became my sponsor put his arm around, he says, we had a boy, son. He says, you're learning. And I started to learn. And that's how I started to learn how to live in this program. And later on, I made the coffee. And I screwed up the first night making the coffee. And you know why that happened? Because after I put all the stuff together and made the coffee, you know, I was ready to put it on. And then something struck me in my mind. When I came back from Okinawa, overseas, I was stationed in Okinawa on 45. And I went on the way home. I went down in a galley, and I seen this guy making the big urns of coffee. And I just needed a cup of coffee, and I said to him, he said, well, don't worry about it, it'll be done in a little while. Sit down, relax. And I had my uniform, and I had my rifle, I had everything together. And I sat down, but the thing I seen him doing when he was doing it, he took the salt box, and he was going like this. And I remembered that. So after I put all the coffee together, I turned around and I looked for a salt box. And the first closet I opened up there, it was right in front of me. I took it up and I started going like this, and the three pots. The first man to come in to have the coffee that night was the crankiest old guy that you ever want to meet. And he tasted that coffee and said, who the hell made it there? Oh, I mean, one of the old timers said, shithead over there in the corner. That's what they named me at the while. I often think about that. But later on, I started to grow in the program. And I started to do things beyond my fondest dreams. And the biggest thing that ever happened to me, and I think I had about 8 months sober, 9 months sober. And my sponsor said, I got a little job in the afternoon for you after you finish work. He took me down to the intergroup office to answer phones. And one day I'm answering this phone, and I'm sitting there, and this gentleman walked in, and everybody's making a big fuss over him, you know, and I said, I wonder who that guy is. So after he went inside, he passed by my desk. He tapped me on the shoulder, he says, nice to see you, young fella. He says, keep up the good work and pass it on, and walked away. So for a few minutes after, everybody went in, he went inside of the office, I guess, to talk to the coordinator, whatever it may be. And I said to the woman behind me, I said, excuse me, I said, but who is that gentleman just walked there? She said, that's Bill W. I said, who the hell is Bill W? I didn't know. Well, I'm new in the program. I didn't know. But, you know, that was the thing that I always want to remember in my days when I came in, that I had the pleasure and the honor to meet him. And later on, I went to one of his conventions, and it was nice. And when I started growing the program, I got active. And start doing things. I went in the group of it, and I started getting involved in the group, and I'd done that for a long time. And then when I moved out of, I was 7 years sober, and I moved out of New York, and I went over to New Jersey, and I did the same thing over there, got active, stayed active. We have what you call a scoop exchange. I did that too, where you're going to book up meetings for one group for the other. You book up, they come into your group to speak, and then they book you to come into their group. And oh, that was fun. And I remember riding with the old timers, you know, and it used to get them maybe two or three cars loads at times. And they always said one guy would get in first, and they'd always put me in the middle. And the other guy get in, so I couldn't go any place. Well, I wasn't going any place anyhow. And then they start telling me their stories of what it was like and what happened to them. And they did that for a long time. And you know, after the meeting was over, you come back to go out to go, and you're back in the car. Oh, you can't go. You got to go in the second car now. That means you had to start all over again on the way back. But you know, I learned so much from them. And they told me to grow slow, son. You had the rest of your life here. First things first. And they got me into the slogans before I got into the steps. And these slogans, each one of those had a meaning. And I had to tell them what that meaning was for me. And then they would, you know, some of them weren't easy, and some were a little softer. And even the tough ones, I loved them just the same. Because I was an orphan. I never had no parents. And all of a sudden I discovered I had fathers and brothers and sisters. I had everybody. Because people like you sit in these rooms gave me the opportunity to grow in this program. And I'm still growing slow. And I'm still having fun. And in this convention, they gave me the beautiful job of being the voice for your convention. And it's great. And I'm having so much fun. You know, one of the things I always close with, you know, is when you stay active. And one of the most important things that the community told me right away, you have to have your sponsor. You get a home group. And you get involved in that group. You don't come into AA and sit down and after the meetings, oh, you walk out and go somewhere else. You join the home group as soon as possible. Because that's the way they get to know you and you get to know them. And they get your phone number. Now, one of the most important things when I was in the beginning, telephone therapy. And boy, I had a call. Now, I remember the second day I was after I come into that meeting, I was supposed to call somebody. It took me a half hour to get a number because I'm shaking. I'm going like this. And really, we had them days you had to dial. You didn't have the buttons you have today. You had to, and I must have a half hour before I finally got a hold of somebody. But you know, that taught me a lesson that I had to have that telephone therapy. And you know, you got to reach out. When you come into AA, reach out. Say hello to Ping. And one of the most important things I tell people when they have a home group, always have a greeter at the door. Because you never know. When that person come in, maybe his first meeting or her first meeting, you want that person to feel comfortable when they come in. Because I've seen in so many groups and people come in there were new and after the meeting they snuck out the door. And they never had a chance. So try to always remember that. You see somebody you never seen before, walk up to that person. And so, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so-and-so, what is your name? And make that person feel comfortable like I was made when I came in these doors 51 years ago. And I always remember these things. And in closing, I always say this, I have God on one hand to reach out and ask for his help and guidance. On my other hand, I reach out to another sick and suffering alcoholic to make them feel comfortable like I have been. And I do it one day at a time. But that's my name of my home group. And I work with other alcoholics. And okay, what kind of guy? We have a disease, and we try to keep it arrested just one day at a time. Working together. It's a we program, not an I program. We do it together. And I'm so happy to see so many people here. I want to say thank you, and God bless you all. I'll see you all tonight.
Joe?
That's what she said, yeah. Well, my name is Joe, alcoholic. And you know, I always tell people when I speak at meetings, I got sober a month before my 24th birthday. And a lot of people think I'm only sober 3 or 4 years because of that. But at any rate, if I live till November, I'll be sober 58 years in this wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it had absolutely nothing to do with me. Nothing to do with me at all. I always go back to my beginnings. I got sober in the University Heights group in the Bronx. They met in the cellar of the high school I had graduated from. A few Bronx boys here. That's good. You know, you can take the boy out of the Bronx. You can't take the Bronx out of the boy. I'll tell you that. You know? But I look at all those things, you know, the things I heard, that tough bunch of hard-nosed recovering drunks. They didn't have any psychobabble. They didn't know what a dysfunctional family was. They all came from one, but they didn't know what it was, you know. And when I first heard that term, I said, well, I was a dysfunctional member of a functional family. So I was getting to be a little more self-honest, you know. But my story of sobriety is not all recovery. I had a lot of sobriety when I had no recovery. And I had a lot of sobriety when my behavior was terrible. You know, I had 8 children in my first marriage. At the time, I was a Catholic who was also a sex maniac at the time. But I had to. I had two children and a beautiful wife and beautiful family when I first came to my first AA meeting. And I remember it very well. I always tell people, I can remember my first AA meeting like it was yesterday, but I can't remember yesterday anymore. But it's okay. You know, that's the way it goes, you know. You know, those are the things you can accept, you know, when you get old. And I think when people talk about old-timers, when I came to AA, an old-timer was somebody who had 3 years. You know, yeah, 3 years, you're an old-timer. And I remember a guy in my home group, they used to use those big old army mugs and had one of those big, we used to call a tin sink with the racks. And this guy said to me one day, you know, Joe, there's a lot of sobriety in washing those mugs after the meeting, huh? So I washed the mugs for a couple of months. Now a new guy came to the group. I said to him, you know, there's a lot of sobriety in washing. So I was receiving an education here, and, you know, I was learning fast. That was my version of passing it on, actually, you know. You know, I think of all those things, and we can sit and laugh, but how tragic sometimes it all was, you know, drinking. A guy asked me, you know, I won't even talk to you about sponsorship, because sponsorship has undergone such a change since I came to AA that I don't understand it anymore. But my sponsor is sitting out there. And if it wasn't for him, he and his wife, I wouldn't have this shirt and tie on. Because I thought a tie was an article of clothing that had disappeared from the male wardrobe. I got about 60 of them hanging in my closet, but I haven't worn one in years. So they ran out and bought me a shirt and tie. In fact, they bought me 2 shirts and tie. I'll have to get another speaking engagement soon. I wish somebody had tipped me off, you know. But anyway, it's okay. It's all right. Not the worst thing that ever happened that I had to wear a tie. But, you know, I look at all the things that my time in AA, at a time when I went to a lot of meetings, when I first came in AA, nobody ever said go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I never said anything like that. But they made sure I went to a lot of meetings. You know, there was 2 guys in my original home group named John White, and they called one guy Big John, the other guy Little John. And Little John was about 6'2", and Big John was about 6'6", you know. And I was standing in the back of the room one night on the open speaker meeting that they used to have on Friday night. And by the way, in those days, everybody wore a suit and a tie, including me, to an AA meeting. And I also wore a fedora. If you didn't have a fedora, you weren't dressed, you know. But anyway, I was standing back there, and this guy was talking about getting what they used to call a DWI over there, driving while intoxicated, they call it, from Long Island. And the more he spoke, you know, the more I stood up. You know, I was coming up. I think I was probably coming up around, I don't know, 4 months, less than 6 months. And this guy, John White, said, what's the matter with you? I said, you know, that never happened to me. I never got a DWI. I never got arrested for drunken driving, because now I was thinking, maybe I don't belong here. You know, maybe I can go out and have a few drinks. And he said to me, that's because you didn't have a car, Joe.
You didn't need one.
Yeah, So I looked at him and I figured, you know, he didn't have to say that to me. So then he said, you got enough trouble walking, Joe. Because when Jim Reedy says an arrested alcoholic, I was an arrested alcoholic when I was 18 years old. But anyway, as I say, as life unfolds, you know, all kinds of things happen to you. And I really did not come to AA to get sober. I didn't. I really came. And I heard one guy say one time he came for a back problem. I want to get his boss up his back, his wife up his back, you know. But that's not why I came. I just came because I was, like, terrified of ending that marriage, which I had been told was going to happen. But anyway, and by the way, that marriage ended anyway in divorce 26 years later, I guess. I went along listening to these guys, and they dragged me around to these meetings, and this guy, John White, said to him, when he put his hand on my shoulder, he said, there's a meeting in the South Bronx group tomorrow night in the basement of St. Jerome's Church, and we expect to see you there. And he had put his hand on my shoulder, which came down to my waist, you know, and I said, I guess I better go there, you know. I mean, they never told me what to do. They never gave me instructions, but they had a message, you know, that they delivered, you know. So So I went down, and I was privileged to hear Joe Minor, who was Joe's story, and Jack Green, who was the Yale man in the big book. And I remember those guys talking, and Joe Minor had a very, really desperate story, and Jack Green was a very entertaining speaker, and Jack Green talked about getting back with his wife after being separated for 3 or 4 years while he was on the road, and traveling around, and he told her he was going to go to AA, and he'd come home drunk every week. So he said, well, in AA, they have a big table full of bottles, and you have to take one drink out of every bottle and stay sober. Otherwise, you know, they won't let you stay there. And I keep failing the test, you know. So he said, a year or so later, when he sobered up, and he took his wife to an open meeting with him, and she was looking for this table with the bottle. You know, sometimes alcoholics, drug addicts, and those kind of people, and gamblers, they lie to you sometimes. It may be really tough to accept that, but it's true, you know. So all those things, you know, I think back to those guys, you know, that first meeting. I remember I was sitting in the back of the room. I had on a pair of prescription sunglasses. I wore glasses all my life. I was very nearsighted, and I had lost 3 pairs of glasses in the last 2 weeks before I came to AA. And I was standing there with these sunglasses on. I had on an Army field jacket and a T-shirt in November. And everybody else had on suits and ties. And I was listening to this guy talk. An old guy. He was about 46. You know, he came on the stage, big, heavy guy. And he started talking about blackouts. And he started talking about the first drink. And my father-in-law, who was a member of that group at the time, was sitting in the car. I kept looking at him because I figured he told this guy about me. You know, I thought it was all a plot, you know. And like I always say, and I also heard a guy at a meeting say once, I wouldn't be so paranoid if everybody wasn't out to get me. So I always remember that. And then one of the guys in that group said, remember, when you recover from your paranoia, they're still out to get you, you know. So sometimes there's no hope. But again, you know, all I can tell you is I went through I won't bother giving you details, but I went through a long and kind of sometimes painful spiritual journey that led me to absolute non-belief in the existence of a celestial being called God. But that's all right. I still stayed sober one day at a time by not drinking. When I was sober 22 years in 1973, I was living in a big house up in West Nyack, New York. And one night a cop rang the doorbell. I didn't know it was a cop, but I opened the door. There was a cop there, and he asked me about a son named Martin that lived in Nyack. And I said yes, and he said he hung himself last night. You know, it's over 30 years ago, and I still can't talk about it too much. I don't want to get too emotional. But, you know, when that happened, I was still working, and I used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to work. And I woke up every morning and said, I'm going to get drunk today. And I had been sober as long as he was alive, 22 years. And the only part of AA that worked for me is I said, if I feel this bad tomorrow, I'm going to get drunk tomorrow. And I started trying to get back into touch with my program. I hadn't been going to many meetings. I used to drop in once in a while. You know, I was sober 22 years. I'm practically a superstar around here, you know. So every now and then I would drop into some group where nobody knew me, you know. And by the way, my home group today is the Lamplighters Group, which meets in cyberspace 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And when you go to a cyberspace meeting, everybody is young and good-looking. I want to tell you that. So you know, it's okay. So all those things that caught me, you know, when my marriage ended in divorce, I met a beautiful lady who's sitting out there today who became my second wife. And our marriage is very good today. We're still together. After 28 years, I thought it was for the weekend, but, you know, that's the way those things get you, you know, I don't know. So anyhow, all of those things, and shortly after we were married in 1980, my 16-year-old son was electrocuted, you know, and I didn't think it was fair that happened twice, you know. And you know, a woman said to me one night at a closed meeting in West Nyack, New York, you know, life isn't a basketball game. You don't get a free throw when you get fouled in life. You got to get up, get back in the game. And I wanted to punch her in the jaw, you know, but I thanked her for saying that to me about a month later. So one day at a time, I have a great life today, a life beyond my wildest expectations. I was a bus driver when I came to AA. And that was another thing in my life, what a crazy life I have. I got a temporary job, they told me, for the summer in 1947 with the Third Avenue Railway, a transportation company. And 35 years later, I was asking my boss, you think I can stop looking around now, you know? But anyhow, it worked out well for me. The MTA came into being. They took over the whole thing. They started giving everybody all kinds of money, and I was retiring. You know, a lot of politics going on. I said, no, I don't want to be a superintendent. You know, I thought a superintendent was the guy who lived in the basement in the apartment house, but they were giving it was a big title for them. So I retired in 1988 and moved to Florida. You know, although one guy told me at work, he says, people don't move to Fort Lauderdale, they escape to Fort Lauderdale. Because he said, that's the destination for all the guys who run scams and everything in New York. Let's go to Fort Lauderdale. But anyway, I did very well with that job. I have a lot of gratitude for that job because, I have a pretty good pension. I've traveled all over the world. We've been to Europe 6 or 7 times. I've been to a lot of meetings in London. And I think my 10 minutes is up. But I'll tell you one story. The first time we went to London in 1982, we went to go to a meeting in a place called Shepherd's Bush in a Catholic church. It was kind of dark. There was 4 or 5 teenagers standing there. And I said to one of the kids, how do you get into this place? And he said to me, I say, you speak like a gangster in the cinema. So I said, oh, yeah? Thanks for letting me share with you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.